verses 33-39, where Jesus and his disciples are questioned about fasting. So starting in verse 33, it says, "Then they said to him, 'Why do the disciples of John fast often and make prayers, and likewise those of the Pharisees, but yours eat and drink?' He said to them, 'Can you make the friends of the bridegroom fast while the bridegroom is with them? But the days will come when the bridegroom will be taken away from them. Then they will fast in those days.' Then he spoke a parable to them. 'No one puts a piece from a new garment on an old one. Otherwise, the new makes a tear, and also the piece that was taken out of the new does not match the old. And no one puts new wine into the old wineskins, or else the new wine will burst the wineskins and be spilled, and the wineskins will be ruined. But new wine must be put into new wineskins, and both are preserved. And no one, having drunk old wine, immediately desires new, for he says, the old is better.'" The parallel accounts in Matthew 9 and Mark 2 read very similar, maybe just with a few added details. We learned that it wasn't just the Pharisees that were asking Jesus this, but also John's disciples were asking the question too. So both were trying to find out why him and his disciples were so different than other devout Jews. And the rest of the answer Jesus gives is primarily identical in the other accounts. So, Jesus is questioned about fasting. Why don't you do it? We've noticed you, we've followed you. And that means that they were being followed, right? They were being observed. And that was one thing they noted. And it was taken as an offense. An offense to the other Jews. We do that. That's something that devout Jews do. Why is that you have been avoiding that? So what's the Lord's answer in general? All right. The time and place. That's right. There's a time, there's a place. The time is not now. That's the general answer. And he gives on essentially a couple of parables to express that concept in language that have been readily understandable. The first one there about the bridegroom and the friends that were with him. And I mean, you go to a wedding, there's going to be food set out there. And it's in a time of feasting and an occasion of joy. And so it would be inappropriate to say at that wedding, "We're now doing a fast," right? It wouldn't mix. It's not the right time and place. And so Jesus immediately connects that to what him and his disciples are doing. Might be appropriate for just a moment to mention the different types of fasts in the Old Testament scriptures. You have fasts that took place from morning to evening at Judges 20:26. Some that lasted a period of days, Esther 4:16. And then you had some that lasted many, many days. Matthew 4:2, you read of Jesus 40 days, Moses 40 days, and so a quite extreme, lengthy fast that they undertook. And almost with all the fasting, there was this connection to it being an evidence of soberness, of even sorrow or mourning for particular instances or evidences that have taken place in one's life. Or it could be penitence. You think about the case of David when he learned his son was going to die, very penitent and just would not desire to eat at all. And so it was a way in which that they expressed their dependence and their humility, I think, overall towards God. That they were in need of God. There was really only one prescribed fast that was commanded in the Old Testament. Does anyone know? Did you do a little reading about that? What that one was? To That's right, Leviticus 23. You can also read of it there in Leviticus chapter 16. It was the Day of Atonement. That was the only day in all the Old Testament that the Jews were commanded to take a fast. And so it was just morning to evening kind of a fast. So all the other fasts that I mentioned at other times were kind of self-imposed fasts. That they had decided, this is what I want to do between me and my God and the relationship that I have with Him. And we see that Jesus here in Luke and Matthew and Mark is certainly authorizing it for the individual. But of course, He'd warn about its abuse later on in the Sermon on the Mount, right? That if you're going to fast, don't, you know, be all drabby and worn out and wearing, you know, last week's clothes so that everyone knows that you're fasting. You should rather make it look like it's a normal day, business as usual, because the fast was between an individual and God. And so we've made mention of this before in other classes that when you have churches or, you know, trying to proclaim fast, that it almost becomes then a duty and obligation that we're doing this, you need to do this, and so that needs to be done. Which, ironically, is the exact argument that John's disciples and the Pharisees were making. We do this, why aren't you doing this, Jesus? Right? So the importance to remember the aspects of our own personal devotion to God, and that it's not predicated on what somebody else may or may not do. When you think about it, all of our service is kind of like that in a way towards God. If someone's looks around and they say, you know, there's a lot of people here aren't here Wednesday night. I don't know if I'm going to show up on Wednesday nights anymore. What are they doing? Well, they're predicating their service on what somebody else did or didn't do, when it's always been about my devotion between me and God and what He has obligated me and what He's asked me to do to show that to Him. And that can be multiplied with anything. Someone's not singing. Well, I'm not sure if I want to sing with, you know. I don't know. No one else really goes to the Christian work meetings. I don't know if I want to do that. You know. And so what we do is ultimately just base what we do or not do on what others are doing. And the Lord has always wanted our own heart, and that it would be seriously 100% committed and devoted to Him. So it wasn't based upon what the disciples of John were doing or the Pharisees were doing. Jesus said the whole point of fasting was that it was a time of sorrow and seriousness and affliction. And that's not the time now for me and my disciples. Just like it wouldn't be appropriate for one to start a fast at a wedding, an occasion of joy. So He draws that comparison. Then He goes on to give some more illustrations. Before I go to that, does anyone have any thoughts or questions about fasting in general, or something we can clarify? Yes. Right, right. Yeah, there's no actual scriptural record of those particular days. But from the historical writings, that's where that's gathered from. Just like when we're going to look in John chapter 5, when Jesus tells the guy, take your mat and walk, and the Pharisees say, wait, that's not lawful for you to do. Well, there's nothing in the Old Testament says that, but in the historical records, they had 39 traditions that were to be respected on the Sabbath. And one of them was carrying your items, such as a mat. And so these have like a historical reality. The closest indication you get is the prayer of the Pharisee that Jesus mentions in Luke 18, where he says, "I fast twice a week." And so that would be the closest scriptural reference there. But usually, traditionally, it was Monday and Thursdays that those were those prescribed days that they did that. But again, nothing in the Old Testament at all. It was just the Day of Atonement that was commanded. One time in a year, it was commanded. Anybody else? Any other questions? I had another reference I wrote down. I just want to just turn to this real quick. I think it will give us a good snapshot view of fasting. Look at Isaiah 58. Isaiah chapter 58. Isaiah 58, there it says in verse 3, "Why have we fasted, they say, and you have not seen? Why have we afflicted our souls, and you take no notice? In fact, in the day of your fast, you find pleasure and exploit all your laborers." And so they understood that that time of fast was a time of afflicting our souls. I mean, it was a struggle. The natural inclination of the human body is, when it runs low on energy, is to feed itself. And so you're resisting that particular natural desire. And it was an affliction. It hurts. If one does it for an extended, especially amount of days, it begins to actually hurt. It afflicts the soul. Well, the Lord said that they were actually doing it for the wrong reasons, though. Verse 4, "Indeed, you fast for strife and debate, and to strike with the fist of wickedness. You will not fast as you do this day, to make your voice heard on high. Is it a fast that I've chosen, a day for a man to afflict his soul? Is it to bow down his head like a bulrush, and to spread out sackcloth and ashes? Would you call this a fast, an acceptable day to the Lord? Is this not the fast that I have chosen? To loose the bonds of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free, that you break every yoke. Is it not to share your bread with the hungry, and that you bring to your house the poor who are cast out, when you see them naked and you cover them, and not hide yourself from your own flesh? Then your light shall break forth like the morning. Your healing shall spring forth speedily, and your righteousness shall go before you. The glory of the Lord shall be your rear guard. Then you shall call, and the Lord will answer. And you shall cry, and he will say, 'Here I am.'" So it was to bring them in a closer relationship with God, a greater dependence upon God, and to actually soften their spirit towards their fellow man. When they feel that pain, that starvation, that, you know, they recognize, one recognizes, you know what, others that are in pain or hurting, I'm a little more sympathetic to them, because I would sure appreciate such sympathy. It has that kind of inherent natural thing built within the practice of fasting. And God says, that's the fasting that I've chosen, that it would actually better a man, not make him more wicked for strife. So we see why it became an important practice, even among the Jews in Jesus' day. And I believe Jesus even says that it's something that the Christian ought to think about today, even though not mandated. Because he said, "After I leave, then my disciples shall fast." So it was understood that they would again pick up this practice at the appropriate time, when Jesus was no longer among them. All right, so if there's no other comments, we'll look at verses 36 through 39 at these other illustrations that he uses. He next talks about putting a new patch on an old garment. And we're back in Luke 5, a new patch on an old garment. What happens when that takes place? All right. It tears, it rips. That's right. It's, again, a mixing and mingling of things that shouldn't be done. Not to the betterment of that new garment that had to be cut up for the old one. And the old one is no better off, right, at all. So again, this mixing at the inappropriate occasions and times, it wasn't right. Now, what you're seeing is the Lord begin to make transition. He deals with a tradition that the Pharisees and John's disciples had set up about fasting. But as Jesus often does, he's the master teacher, he sees it as a segue into something that is of a greater importance. And that is this mentality that is so resistant to what he was going to be bringing, which was so different to what they had known. Because Jesus in the gospel, in the new covenant, is not just applying a patch to the old covenant, that this can go along with that. But he's saying that they just don't mix. And in fact, to try and apply the two together will end in disastrous results. So this goes beyond just their understanding of the traditions that they had set up and established in their own name, but even the Mosaic covenant. All of these are not going to be the standards by which to judge one another. Romans chapter 7 is a good chapter, scripture to look at. Romans 7. And think about that illustration of the Lord, the new patch, the old garment, trying to apply one to the other. Well, in Romans chapter 7, it says in verse 1, "Or do you not know, brethren, for I speak to those who know the law, that the law has dominion over man as long as he lives." So he illustrates that. Verse 2, "For the man who has a husband is bound by law to her husband as long as he lives. But if the husband dies, she is released from the law of her husband. So then if while her husband lives she marries another man, well, she'll be called an adulteress. But if her husband dies, she's freed from that law, so that she is no adulteress, though she has married another man." So Paul gives him an illustration that everybody can agree on. If a woman's married to a man, and then she leaves that man for another man, she is an adulteress. Why? Because God says she's still joined to that first man. She's trying to be with this man number two, but she's still joined with the other man. So she's mixing things that are not appropriate. But Paul's intent was to actually apply this to the mixing of the old and new law. And so he says that next in verse 4. "Therefore, my brethren, you also have become dead to the law through the body of Christ, that you may be married to another, to him who was raised from the dead, that we should bear fruit to God." And so he said, through Christ, we're dead to that old law and joined to Christ, as to speak, as in marriage, so to speak, right? So he goes on to say there in verse 5, "For when we were in the flesh, the sinful passions were aroused by the law, were at work in our members to bear fruit to death. But now we've been delivered from the law, having died to what we were held by, so that we should serve in the newness of the Spirit and not in the oldness of the letter." So he says essentially, you're dead to the old law and married to Christ. And dear Christian friend, if you try to go back to that old law or take parts of it and incorporate it with the new law, then you're just like that woman who left man number one for man number two. It's inappropriate. So the Lord uses, way back when, an illustration, though, of a new garment or a new patch on an old garment. It'll rend. They're not meant to be compatible as competing or correlating standards of authority in one's life and religious service to the Lord. And of course, this applies just essentially to the dissolving of the old covenant in regards to its authoritative power. Colossians 2:14 says, Colossians 2:14, "Having wiped out the handwriting of requirements that was against us." Taken it out of the way, having nailed it to the cross. So something was nailed to the cross. Something was taken out of the way. Something was wiped out. What was it? Well, it was the handwriting requirements that was against us, as reference to the old law. The old law. It certainly wasn't the new. It was the old law. And one can also add Galatians 3 and pretty much the whole book of Hebrews. That had to be over and over again illustrated. So the Lord starts off first with a discussion about fasting, which was kind of built up and predicated on one of their traditions, and then he goes and transitions to the whole system of the old covenant. And he'll talk about old and new, new and old, with the remainder of those illustrations. Let's look at the next one. Any comments or questions while we're turning back to Luke 5? Nancy? You know that realistically, because that you're sewing. Mm-hmm. Right.
If you cut it out that pattern and then wash it, it's going to shrink in the great shape. Same way with the wine, the old wine bag, it's already shrunk. You know, shrunk. You put the new wine, the grape juice in there, and it permeates, it's going to swell it. The material can't, the libraries can't swell with it, or the wine skin is what's going to happen. It's
right, right. In the old ones, it even had the on the outer layer of the inside of the old ones, the sugar and all of the skins from the grape that would have produced some of that fermentation. So to put it inside of that same one would add even, I mean, the force would be exponentially greater. Expand, that's right. Exactly. And often they were putting those skins to actually prohibit that fermentation. They would put it into the water and then keep it cool to keep it a juice as long as they could. But then as the yeast, they'd add the extra yeast and the sugar and those kinds of things, it would begin that fermentation process if they were trying to make it fermented. But the illustration was a pretty simple one, is that you understand essentially the new and the old, you just can't mix them. Otherwise, you lose them both, really. You lose the old wineskin, and you lose all the new grape juice. And so, again, another powerful illustration to say that, you know, when you begin mixing and mingling, you know, if we use the old covenant, well, they use instruments of music because they did that in the old covenant, right? And we don't have a New Testament verse that shows that, but they did that in the old covenant. Well, the Lord says, now you've essentially put new wine in the old wineskin, and it's going to burst, because you're not going to have a leg to stand on when someone comes along and says, well, I'd like to offer my pet lamb as a sacrifice. You know, I think it'd be appropriate that we go ahead and start burning incense, and let's build a replica altar like they had in the temple. Let's do something like that. Well, we wouldn't have a leg to stand on. Why? No, we can't do that. Well, why not? Well, because we're in the new covenant. Why do you have an instrument of music? You see, the new wine bursts the old wineskins. You can't mix and mingle. In terms of how we serve the Lord today, we must use His covenant. Doesn't mean we don't learn from the old. We've been doing that with Moses for, you know, some odd weeks. But we have to understand the new covenant is our authority, our religious guidance today. And so the Lord is masterfully transitioning from something that was of little consequence to something that was of great consequence. These concepts that they have to understand. And He even tells them, I know you're not going to like it at first, right? Because no one likes the new at first. They say the old is better. In fact, they're not even willing to often try the new, because they are... we're creatures of habit, and we're raised this way, and this is what you know, and that was going to be a big stumbling block for a majority of the Jews. This is all we know, and we have to give this up for you. No one immediately desires the new. He says the old. They say the old is better. Comments? Yes.
You were talking about the Jews were used to the old, and they didn't they didn't want to change. Years ago when I was in Russia, that's exactly what they said about things. This is not how we do it. And they're not willing to, a lot of times, to look at something else.
Right, right. Exactly. And it's important for us to remember, too, that you know, Jesus isn't talking about progressivism like we know it today in America, but contrasting the old law versus the new. We need to guard against having a mentality that, you know, let's have change for change's sake, because that often leads you astray. And that's not what the Lord is asking here. He's asking for a monumental change from what they had known, because it had been part of God's plan. Jeremiah 31:31, the days are coming, you know, when I will establish a new covenant with the house of Israel, the house of Judah. This is part of God's stepping process. And the Lord was saying, it's here, it's here. Any final thoughts about what Jesus says here in regards to fasting before we go to John 5?
What I was thinking about is like in Isaiah, where God says that He was the husband of Israel. So in the New Testament, Christ is in Ephesians 5 and in Revelation is talked about as being the groom, the church being the bride. So in both occasions, I can see the deity of Christ, because He compares Himself to God in the Old Testament. And the joy that we have, because of the benefits that we receive through Christ in the New Testament.
Right, right.
So, you know, it's like you said, it's more of an individual thing. It's not to be displayed. It's supposed to be secret.
Right. Their scientists are actually studying more and more about fasting recently too, and finding, you know, various benefits to it. Though the fasting the Lord talked about was a spiritual one, but it reminds me about Deuteronomy 6, where He said that my ways are for your good always. The Lord has never put upon us something that would actually destroy us, but actually these are all blessings. And I believe a Christian that would practice it would find better tools to against anxiety, and you know, it brings a certain peace, as we remind ourselves we are dependent upon God to take care of all of our needs. And so there's these blessings that are in these commands and these examples that are for our good always. But you're right, we have to be careful that we don't ever mandate it, because that destroys the purpose of it, the individual aspect of it between us and God, which is what the disciples of John and the Pharisees were doing. They were doing that. Anybody else? All right. Let's go to John chapter 5. John, the 5th chapter. Now, John 5, we find Jesus back now at Jerusalem. A feast is going on. I believe it to be the Passover. There's some that aren't sure exactly if that's the case, and it's really not a major point one way or the other. But here we see Jesus there, and at this time, you think about how a lot of folks would come up to Jesus. We've already read it, that they might be healed, taken care of. Here we see an occasion where Jesus goes up to somebody else. This person didn't seek Him out. This person doesn't even know who He is. And so it's very different to a lot of the other healings that we have seen so far. So in John chapter 5, verse 1, it says, "After this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool, which is called in Hebrew Bethesda, having five porches. And these lay a great multitude of sick people, blind, lame, paralyzed, waiting for the moving of the water. For an angel went down to a certain time into the pool and stirred up the water. Then whoever stepped in first after the stirring of the water was made well of whatever disease he had. Now a certain man was there who had an infirmity 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he already had been in that condition a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be made well?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no man to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up. But when I am coming, another steps down before me." Jesus said to him, "Rise, take up your bed and walk." And immediately the man was made well, took up his bed and walked. And that day was the Sabbath. So here we see the occasion of this miracle that Jesus does on the man. And then the next part we'll see the man actually then going on his way and talking with some others that stop him. What a wonderful occasion to see how the Lord is aware of us even though we may not be aware of Him. And I think that's always a peaceful thought to remember. That when we feel, has He forgotten me or has He overlooked me? Well, here's a person that didn't even know Him. How much more so those that are His children, His brothers, His sisters, those that do the will of God. He doesn't overlook us. And he goes up to this man who had this infirmity nearly as many years as I've been alive. 38 years. And Jesus asked him, "Do you want to be made well?" Now, if he'd have known it was Jesus, he'd say, "Yes, please cure me." But he says, "I have no one to take me to the pool," because that's where they had decided it was a way in which they could receive some kind of healing if they were the first one to get in the pool. And so you almost get the idea that, you know, can you stay here and help me? So once that pool is stirred, we can go down, you can take me into it. It was an indication or a hint of that. Well, Jesus is the one that had the power. He had the ability. So Jesus says, "Rise, take up your bed, and walk." And immediately the man was in real. Somehow, some way, he knew, he felt it. He could. There was strength in the legs that he had not been able to observe in 38 years. And so he gets up. And he takes his bed and he walks away. And the Bible mentions in passing that the day was the Sabbath day. Now, he was just so shocked, he didn't take a moment to think, you know, "Who are you? You know, this is amazing. Thank you." You know, he does what the Lord says, takes up his bed, and he walks away. Uh-oh, but he's going to run into a problem for that. Right? You've got the tradition inspectors out on watch. And we see in verse 10, it says, "The Jews therefore said to him who was cured, 'It is the Sabbath. It is not lawful for you to carry your bed.' He answered them, 'He who made me well said to me, take up your bed and walk.'" Notice he didn't say Jesus said to me, but the one that made me well. "Well," they said, "who is the man who said to you, take up your bed and walk?" But the one who was healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had withdrawn, a multitude being in that place. So we've mentioned before, and we'll mention again, that to say that one, in order to be healed of their disease or sickness, must have a whole lot of faith. Well, this verse shows that's not the case, right? Because this man didn't even know who Jesus was. Not at all. He didn't know him before. He didn't even know him after. And yet he was able to walk. And so the miracles are faith producing, but not faith dependent. See that? They produce faith, but they're not dependent upon someone's faith. Now there'll be other occasions where the Lord would say, "You can be made well if you believe," you know, and we understand that He's asking them to believe that He can do this. But here we see that it's not dependent upon that. And the same would be so today with these fake miracle healers that will say, "If you just have enough faith, then you can be made well." No, that's never been the case. Well, One of the, as I mentioned earlier, the list of 39 traditions that were established by the Jews of the day that one needed to respect if they didn't want to work on the Sabbath, one of them was carrying your bed, carrying your mat. From what I understand, it wouldn't have been a very heavy mat, just a straw kind of pillow, enough where you can roll up, tuck under your arm, and walk. The man wasn't trying to do any of his labor. He probably wasn't employed. He'd been disabled for so long. He was just doing as Jesus asked and going on his way. Well, they want to know, who is it that said this to you? Isn't that something? Instead of fantastic, this is amazing. Praise God. They were hung up on him carrying a mat. That's right. Mom and I were talking about this a little bit this afternoon, that you have individuals like the centurion that didn't see Jesus, but they believed what he was able to do. They had heard what he had done, and so had sent individuals to try and help heal them. But then you have those individuals, not only in this one, but remember the guy that was led through the roof, and after that was done, they were reasoning in their hearts, why is this man doing this? You know, these kinds of things. Why speaking blasphemies? Who can forgive sins? So not only do they hear it, but they also see it. They hear and they see. They hear and they see. And yet, they don't believe. And yet we read of people that just heard, didn't see, and they believed and rewarded for it. And you think about it, that's the category that anyone that's going to come to the Lord today is going to fit in. We don't get to see, but we get to hear. And we get to see with the eye of faith, but we don't get to see in reality. But there's people that saw in reality and they still didn't believe, or were cold and didn't care. Makes you sad to think that there's people that would so reject what was obviously true.
This man here, he listened, he had to obey, and he had to take action. If he did not obey, he would not have been healed. If he did not take action, he would not, if he hadn't gotten up and done so, he also would not have been healed. So it shows that he did listen to Jesus. He did obey Jesus, and he took the appropriate action. Jesus had asked him to do so.
He's willing to get up, take his bed, and go. I wonder if the Lord would have healed him anyway, though, because it says immediately. But he still had to get up to see that that was the case. He still had to try to get up.
And I really question whether the Jews really didn't know who had done this, because Jesus had been performing miracles before. And so they reason among themselves that he was a prophet or Elijah or something like that. But I think they knew that it was Jesus that had done this, and he was confronting them on this tradition that they had.
There was nobody else in the community healing people.
Right.
Jesus and Jesus alone.
Right. And he was doing indisputable miracles. 38 years, or born blind, or, you know, it just, they couldn't, there, no one could say that was a fakery. Like you said, they knew these individuals. They'd been around for some time. So most likely they did have an idea. They just wanted to hear who it was, but he didn't know who it was. Now what you see next is verse 14. This man finds Jesus again. And where does he find him? In the temple. So most likely this man, after this first initial elation of joy, is wanting to go and thank God, you know, and to spend time with God and with God's people, to be close to God. And what a great illustration for us. And if we think about it or parallel ourselves to this man who is lame, as us in sin are also lame. We are disabled spiritually, and only the Lord can make us well. And after made well, let us find ourselves in the temple of God, in the house of God, the church, which is the pillar and ground of the truth. And there he finds Jesus, and there he would understand who he was. And Jesus says to him, "See, you have been made well. Sin no more, lest the worst thing come upon you." So, what we see here is while the Lord did have compassion and did seek to heal individuals, he never wanted to forget what it was really all about, and that is about saving the soul. The spiritual disease, the spiritual lameness, right, or sickness, that's what he wanted to heal. So sin no more, lest the worst thing come upon you. Worse than being unable to walk for 38 years? I mean, that'd be really hard to believe, but there is. There's a place where it lasts for eternity. And so don't be involved in sin. Depart from it. Cease sin.
Same thing you said in the woman caught in adultery. Go and sin no more.
Yes. Go and sin no more. Great words for those that have been healed. As Christians, that's our goal, right? We don't want to sin any more. And so we have to work at that. Yes. No, I'm sure the thought will go through everyone's mind, but it will be more than just a thought. It'll be more than just a thought. It'll be reality. That's right. In a twinkling of an eye.
Mm-hmm.
Alright, I'll leave you with that last thought then. Let's go ahead and close our class. We'll pick up here in John 5 on Sunday. Lord willing.